Welcome back to On the Arts. I'm David LaTulipe. This week, we set the Wayback Machine to just prior to the pandemic, and my final in-studio guest back in 2020, Sting. He was in San Francisco promoting the musical he created, The Last Ship, which tells the story of the demise of the shipbuilding industry in his hometown of Wall's End, England. The Last Ship was initially inspired by Sting's 1991 album, The Soul Cages, and Sting's own childhood experiences, particularly his relationship with his father, who had been an engineer in a family of shipwrights. The musical received 2 Tony Award nominations back in 2015 for Best Original Score and Best Orchestrations. And the U.S. tour of The Last Ship debuted on January 22, 2020, in Los Angeles. The musical then moved to San Francisco, opening on February 25th at the Golden Gate Theater. The U.S. tour, however, was then suspended due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to Sting, cast member Frances McNamee joins the conversation. Please note that, once again, this is an archived interview and that performance dates mentioned are from 2020.
It's all there in the Gospels. A Magdalene girl comes to pay her respects, but her mind is a whirl when she finds the tomb empty. The stone had been rolled, not a sign of a corpse. In the dark and the cold, when she reaches the door, sees an unholy sight. There's this solitary figure in a halo of light. He just carries on floating past Calvary Hill in an almighty hurry. Aye, but you might catch him still. Tell me, where are you gone, Lord, and why in such haste? I don't hinder me, woman, I've no time to waste. Or they're launching a boat on the morrow at noon, and I have to be there before daybreak. Oh, I cannot be missing. The lads will expect me. Why else would the good Lord himself resurrect me? For nothing will stop me. I have to prevail through the teeth of this tempest, in the mouth of a gale. May the angels protect me if all else should fail. When the last ship sails, or the roar of the chains and the cracking of timbers, the noise at the end of the world in your ears, as a mountain of steel makes its way to the sea, and the last ship sails.
That's the unmistakable voice and an excerpt from The Last Ship, which happens to be the title of a touring show now at the Golden Gate Theater through March 22nd. It's not often that a radio host gets to talk with someone that's known by one word. No, not Beyoncé, not Prince, not Liberace, for that matter. And heck, even Elvis was also no more fully as Elvis Presley. But the author of the song we heard and the subject of this next segment on Open Air is none other than 17-time Grammy Award winner, not to mention countless other awards and honors, the artist not formerly known as, but forever recognizable as, Sting. Sting, welcome to our studios.
Nice to be here, David. Thank you.
Well, I have to admit that I am a little nervous about this, not because of all the baggage that goes hand in hand with a one-name celebrity and all that, but because, frankly, you're my first guest that has been had a species of Colombian tree frog named after him. I believe it's Dendrosophis stingi, named after you for your commitment and efforts to save the rainforest.
One of the best-looking frogs in the Amazon, actually.
Well, it's too bad that they couldn't have discovered a wasp to name after you. I think that might have been perfect.
Well, I was named after a bezoar, so, you know, let's just get over it.
Well, you know, on a serious note, it must be particularly devastating for you during these recent months with the rash of fires in the rainforest in Brazil. And we should say that thanks to you and your wife, Trudy Steyer's efforts, more than $30 million has been raised through your annual concerts and hands-on activism to combat rainforest destruction. So what are your feelings about what happened, happening down there?
What's happening in Brazil is not natural. It's actually political. and the government there is encouraging the burning of the rainforest. I can't think of a suitable analogy, but if you imagine that the Italian government were to collect all the Leonardo or the, let's say, the Michelangelo sculptures and take them to a quarry and reduce them to powder so they could make cement, can you imagine the outrage? International would be off the scale. What's happening in the Amazon, this isn't even close. Something that's taken millions of years to develop is priceless, completely priceless and unique, is being destroyed because they see an oil field or they see some gold there or some precious stones. But what they're destroying is irreplaceable. And so my analogy is pathetic. There isn't the outrage that the destruction of Michelangelo's work would be, and there should be. Mm.
Well, thank you for the funds and the awareness that you're raising just through all your efforts with Trudy especially. As you arrived, I noticed the obvious beneficial effects of yoga that have kept you, shall we say, for radio, looking fine. I'm wondering now, at 68, have you had to bring some of your songs down a step or two, or has good vocal health been as integral to your life as yoga?
No, I haven't. I still sing High C and Roxanne. To this date, I'm touching wood as I do that. It's, you know, it's athletic. Singing is, it's a muscle, and you keep it stretched and trained and pliable, and it still works. One day it won't. Hmm. Hopefully not this week.
Well, you've got a broken wing as well. We're both suffering through rotator cuff surgery. How did that happen?
I wish it was exciting. I just fell over in October, and then they gave me the surgery, and I was on stage the next night. So I was pretty cavalier about the whole thing, only to have to repeat the surgery last week.
Oh, man.
So they've retied my muscles together, and I'm going to be a little less cavalier about my recovery.
It kind of works into your character on stage. You have a swagger now with the...
Well, I have to wear it on stage, but it does help the, you know, the gravitas of the character who's, you know... I think it does, anyway. I was talked out of a parrot on my shoulder and an eye patch, but an added color.
We should mention, before we move on to the subject of the last ship, that on the subject of philanthropy, that a portion of Trudy's, what, 5-6 yoga DVDs filmed on your beautiful Tuscany estate benefit UNICEF, and that's also a wonderful gesture. So thank you both for your continued dedication to healing the earth and raising awareness. Should also mention that Trudy's directorial debut film in 2017, Freak Show, was featured as part of the Frameline Film Fest here in San Francisco, magnificently received with memorable performances by Bette Midler, among others. So I hope she's doing some more directing.
She is going to do more directing, but she's producing this week in London a film called Silent Night with Keira Knightley. So she's busy.
Mm, indeed. Now, thinking back on that opening track, The Last Ship, one can really hear the lilt of the waves in those repeated phrases. And that song speaks the story of what the musical is about to unfold. But I'm wondering if I can get you to read from your 2003 autobiography, Broken Music. Now, this is well before the musical was ever hit the footlights. And it's about your town and the shipyard's demise.
The whole town seems to be suffering a slow, painful death. Orders for the tankers that had kept the shipyard and the town alive have gradually dried up. The industry has been undercut by the heavily subsidized Korean and Japanese consortiums, and there have been massive layoffs of hundreds of skilled workers. A few repair jobs are barely enough to keep a fraction of the workforce in employment. There are no more steel leviathans blotting out the sun at the end of the terraced streets. An industry that had taken centuries to build up has been allowed to die almost overnight. And the collective skills and shipbuilding crafts of the town have been thrown onto a scrap heap of terminal unemployment. The bustling high street of my childhood is now a deserted thoroughfare of empty shops. The economic downturn has affected my father's business as well as everyone else's and accomplished what the German bombers had failed to do. All's End has had the beating heart ripped out from it. It seems like a ghost town now.
That was Sting reading from his 2003 autobiography, Broken Music. I'm David LaTulipe. So pleased to be talking with Sting live here on Open Air on KLW. Really beautiful writing, by the way. I mean, so descriptive with an attention to detail that your memory must be fantastic to recall
It's interesting. Once you start writing a biography, one memory engenders another 10. So every time you pull a memory out of the well, 10 more, and then 10 more. It's kind of exponential. And out it comes. Stuff that you may have suppressed or you may have, you know, wanted suppressed comes out anyway. Mm-hmm. It's good therapy.
Indeed. I think of you more as a storyteller than a songwriter, and I think that comes through.
Is there a difference?
Interesting, yeah.
Well, you're telling a story. I think, you know, music tells a story, as our friend from Volte said. Often music can communicate without words. It tells a story. It has an abstract meaning. My job as a lyricist is to pull out the meaning, the abstract meaning, from the melody, from harmony. But it can still communicate whether you understand it or not.
Hmm. The title of the book, Broken Music, by the way, comes from what I understand your grand's description of your genuinely, at the time, juvenile piano playing, yes?
I was a 12-tone serialist, even at 7 years old. I used to hammer that thing. I was angry. And it came out in music. But broken music is also a term from the Elizabethan era of breaking music into voices. So there's more to it than just anger.
Mm. And she asked you to just stop playing that broken music. Now, interestingly enough, you chose to open the book with an experience you and Trudy had down in Mexico, a first dip into the hallucinogenic ayahuasca ritual.
It was in Brazil, actually.
Brazil, yeah. Right. Which you did just prior to your huge Rio gig in 1987. Now, why start the book that way?
It was a real, it was an eye-opener. You know, I'd paid lip service to the idea of religious experience up till then. I was brought up Catholic in a very Catholic community.
Recovering Catholic myself, yeah.
You know, two of my uncles became priests. And so, but I never really had a religious experience until I went into the jungle and was giving this hideous tasting brew, and I went into a trance for 5 or 6 hours and basically relived my life from birth to death. And I would say it was genuinely terrifying and ego shattering, but incredibly important for my reconnection with the world, reconnection with nature. The idea that we are separate from nature is absurd and diabolical. You know, diabolical means split into two, and human beings are split into two. This experience managed to pull me back together again.
And I'm just thinking, though, prior to this huge Rio gig, weren't you a little scared that the experience might screw up your voice a little bit prior to this big concert?
No, I wanted to have this experience, and it was worth the risk. It didn't screw my voice up at all. It actually made me sing better. But you know, I was given the opportunity, and so I took it.
While we're on the book, there's a great passage from an experience in Paris that I'm hoping you will also share with us about how everything got started. Let me see if I can find that.
You want me to read it again?
Please.
Okay. I'm not sure I want to do this. Anyway, okay. While in Paris, we play the Nashville Club, a seedy velveteen music hall in Saint-Germain, and are staying for a few nights in a flop house behind the Gare de Saint-Lazare. The entrance of our hotel is in a narrow and fetid alleyway off the main boulevard. In early evening, it is flanked by the garish lights of a sex shop and a dimly lit second-hand bookstore. The alley is a pitch for about 20 women leaning in doorways, chain-smoking. In their shiny, open raincoats, short skirts, cheap boots, and high-heeled shoes, they watch the street with hooded eyes like spies in a B-movie. Some are young and pretty. Some are older, and some of them are very old, with facial expressions ranging from sullen to wry. Most of the commerce is centered on the slightly older women, as if the majority of the clients prefer experience and worldliness. The younger, prettier girls seem to do the least business, apparent innocence being only a minority preference, much as it is for the aging crones in the alley who seem to have been standing there for 1,000 years. Where are we going with this thing? In the dingy I've forgotten this passage. In the dingy foyer of the hotel is an old poster from La Comédie Française, sadly peeling from the wall behind the desk. Cyrano de Bergerac, it proclaims, a play by Edmond Rostand. I will stand for a few moments to take in its fading gaiety. It is a laughing portrait of a man with an enormous nose and a plumed hat. He is a tragic clown, whose misfortune is his honour. He is a man entrusted with a secret, an eloquent and dazzling wit who, having successfully wooed a beautiful woman on behalf of a friend, cannot reveal himself as the true author when his friend dies. He is a man who loves but is not loved, and the woman he loves but cannot reach is called Roxanne. That night I will go to my room and write a song about a girl. I will call her Roxanne. I will conjure her unpaid from the street below the hotel and cloak her in the romance and the sadness of Rostand's play, and her creation will change my life.
Excerpt from Roxanne, whose last name we don't even get to know, written by a gentleman with no last name. What's your on your passport, by the way, Sting? Is it just
it's a secret?
Secret safe with me, of course. One of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. In 2008, Roxanne was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. Nice royalties from that, I'm sure. On the, still rolling in. Now, in 2003, you were honored by being made a commander of the Order of the British Empire, just a level shy of being called a sir. Now, I though, will revel in my own mind of Her Majesty Elizabeth II dubbing sword in hand, calling you Sir Sting, but I guess that didn't happen.
She said to me, how's the rainforest? I said, it's still burning, ma'am. And she said, are you still in the music business? I said, barely. And then she pinned this thing on me. So I have the same rank as James Bond. And I'm too young to be a sir.
Good company you're keeping, though. Give us a little glimpse of your creative process. Do you keep a notebook for both lyrics and melodies that come to you? Do you ultimately compose at the piano, or has the world of computer technology taken over the process?
I avoid it like the plague. Mm. It's painful for me to have to write new songs. So I do it when I have to do it. I'm usually, there's an anxiety at the center of my creative process, an emptiness, and I have to fill it at some point. At the moment, I'm blithely happy just to be drifting through life, doing the play.
We'll talk about some future projects maybe a little later. So, Broken Music, written in 2003. This musical growing out from your 1992 album, The Soul Cages, a tribute of sorts to your late parents. Leading to the creation of the original show, The Last Ship, back in 2010. Broadway accolades in 2015, two Tony nominations, a subsequent tour of the UK, a national tour in 2018, a six-week run in Toronto 2019, and now the 2020 North American tour, which kicked off last month in Los Angeles. Now here in San Francisco, as I mentioned, through the 22nd of March. What motivated you to tell this story as a musical?
Interesting. I wrote The Soul Cages. As you say, it was the inspiration was the shipyard closing down, which seemed to be a suitable metaphor for my parents dying. They both died in the same year, very young. My mother was 54. My father hadn't got to 60 yet. And it was my way of mourning. My rather extravagant way of mourning. And but I always thought the idea of the shipyard had a theatrical component attached to it. There was an epic quality to the shipyard, the size of it. Armies of men walking down past my front door, these gigantic ships, the noise. And so I thought there was kind of an operatic quality about it. And I started to write songs and realized that these songs had been gestating in me for a long, long time. The imagery, the characters I knew, just couplets, they poured out of me like projectile vomiting, as if they'd been waiting for a moment for you know, this thing to happen. So the last ship was written very quickly, within a matter of weeks.
And semi-biographical, I understand. Autobiographical.
There's more of me in the play than I had intended, and I notice it nightly. Oh, that's what that's about. So in a way, a sort of self-revealing in a slow way.
And I hope a good way, too.
Oh, a very good way.
This production has a new director, Lauren Campbell, who also hails from Newcastle, and has brought his own vision to the piece, adding his own personal experience to this updated version of John Logan and Brian Yorkey's original book. So what's changed since its birth some, 10 years ago now, 6 years?
It's changed a lot. I mean, the arc of the story was as it was original. It was about the workers taking over the shipyard and finishing their own ship and launching the ship as a gesture against the economic turndown, and that's still the same. What this production has different about it is the agency of women, how important the women of the community are, one of them played by Frances here. Maybe you want to speak about that, Frances.
Oh,
let's welcome Frances McNamee to the conversation. Welcome,
hi.
Frances.
Hi, nice to be here.
And your character, Meg Lawson.
Dawson.
Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
Who is she?
Meg runs the pub that the shipbuilders drink in, called the Ship in the Hole. And kind of by accident, she's become a bit of a pillar of the community. She's suffered setbacks early on in her life that her soulmate, her best friend, the love of her life, left her when they were both very young. And we find her 17 years later, and he's come back. So her journey through the play is navigating that rather beautiful and complex love story against the backdrop of the ship building community dying, basically.
Well, we've heard a lot of this guy's voice already, Frances, but can you give our audience a taste of your beautiful Irish lilt in song?
Irish? Oh. I'm half Irish, so you're kind of half right, yeah. I don't know, are we going to sing something together?
Sure.
Oh, that'd be marvellous.
Remember what the B-flat sounds like?
Mm-hmm. Beep. August will start turning. The fishing boat set out upon the sea. I watched the lid into the night beneath the falls. What's happened? Should we do it again? Let's do it again.
Sure. I thought I was singing the right lyrics.
I think it was a mashup of two different verses.
Oh,
I think.
I'm sorry.
No. Sorry.
If a little Carnegie Hall will help the atmosphere, yeah. Go ahead.
Go on, I'll follow you.
Okay. August winds are turning, the fishing boat set out upon the sea. I watch as they jumped out of sight, the winter follows soon. I'll watch them drawn into the night beneath the August moon. And in my public moments, I hear the things I say, but they're not me.
Perhaps I'll know before I die, admit that there's a reason why I count the boats returning from the sea. I count the boats returning from the sea.
Ha ha ha.
Lovely indeed. Sting and Francis McNamee here at live in the KLW studios with an excerpt from The Last Ship, Sting's reworked musical, now at the Golden Gate Theater through March 22nd. Thank you for indulging us with that. So, so beautiful. And just hum if you forget the words, you know. Hey. Yeah.
They were the right words. They were just in the wrong order.
You mentioned how the role of women figures prominently, especially as the second act begins, both live on stage and with recorded TV footage from the time. In fact, a great deal about the new book celebrates the true backbone of the town, its women. And is that what you learned? What was the role of the women?
I was writing changed. About a time in my childhood. I was born in the 50s when women's role was very much sat upon. And yet they were strong women. But, you know, culturally, the man of the house had absolute sway. And this rewrite, men have failed on every level. And so it's up to the women to take the situation in hand and save us. And I think that's very, very topical. Maybe not historical, but it resonates with what's going to happen now.
Mm. Well, I'm seeing some parallels to the coal miner strike in Thatcherian England, something you must have lived through.
It's pretty close. I mean, there were two things in my town. There was a shipyard at one end of the town and a coal mine in the other.
Mm.
Both defunct now. Not that I'm sad about the coal mines. They were, again, hellish places to work in. And not very good for the environment. But a community depended on them.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the value of community out from economic theories, abstract economic theories, you lose something priceless. And basically, it's untenable. You might make your quarter profits better, but in the long term, in the medium term, without community, economics do not work, in my opinion.
Mm. You've been quoted in our own San Francisco Chronicle as saying this has been, quote, immensely difficult, immensely frustrating, but also exciting and fun.
I think it's the hardest thing I've ever tackled in my life, to write an original musical. Musicals are usually fairy stories or the Disney properties that everyone knows or a popular movie that everybody likes. To start from scratch is really to invite all kinds of trouble on your head. But having done that, it's the most satisfying thing of my life. I love this play.
Mm. Well, of course, Sting, it's your name and reputation that are pulling in the box office. You're very much part of an ensemble cast here, and it's a huge cast, Francis among them. What's it like to not be the center of attention all the time?
Aren't I? I actually love it. I love being part of the ensemble, being thought of as one of the actors, being treated just as one of the actors. That's what I wanted. I never intended to be in this play in the first place. I wrote it for other people. I saw the economic sense of me going into it at one point, saying, okay, well, we'll sell more tickets this way. But that was not my intention. But having wet my feet in the thing, I'm enjoying the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm. And what's been your role in assembling the cast, finding wonderful voices like Frances?
Well, as soon as Frances McNamee walked through the door, I said, that's our Meg. And she didn't even have to sing. And then when she sang, that was it. Game over.
I should say, Frances, that you did the UK tour of the show. You were in the West End production of Big Fish back in 2017 as well. Nominated for UK's Theatre Awards Best Performance in a Musical.
Yeah.
Tons of other theatre credits. So what's it like in this production for you?
This has been the high. I've been doing this for about 10 years professionally, and this is obviously the highlight so far. It's an incredible part. It's an incredible cast. The music is a joy to sing. And I'm keeping company like this. It doesn't really get much better. And to be able to learn from somebody that has been in the business for as long as Sting has is a treat and an honor. So yeah, I'm pretty happy right now.
Nice. And you've gotten the weather favorable for you here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how extensive is this tour? I understand that you're going to D.C., to St. Paul, and Detroit. you might find some similarities to your hometown of Walsen there.
I think Detroit particularly, there'll be a resonance there with a town or city built upon one industry, which is in trouble. But I've been surprised at how resonant the ideas of the play are everywhere. We were in Los Angeles last month, and people resonated with it there. I think the sense that the social contract has broken down, that people are thrown off the edge and there's no hope for them to come back. And I've been witnessing this here in San Francisco, walking from the hotel to my theater.
You're in a tough neighborhood, that's for sure.
Seeing people on the street, clearly no way of getting back. It's terribly sad. This is the wealthiest state in the wealthiest country in the world. This should not be happening. This something needs to be done. So, our play does address that.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to your hometown of Wallsend, one of the things that helped revitalize it or added to its cachet is the establishment of a music school there. There's a really touching moment from the documentary Inside Out, where you go back to Wallsend to visit your old colleague Jerry's music students. And you can't sing, because your doctor's orders, you can sing. And you asked if any of the students that knew your tunes would like to come up. And this kid just blew you away, and everyone that watched that documentary. Part of your revisiting Newcastle to open that school. And this musical is about how the townspeople regain their pride and change their destiny.
I think so. I think it's a play about human dignity and the dignity of work, identity. Without those things, there's not much left. But also music helps. Music is a great medicine.
You kept track of that kid? Or his career?
He's probably got a bigger career than me now.
Well, tell me how The Night the Pugilist Learned How to Dance worked its way into the story.
Well, it was important for our leading man, who's played by Olivia Saville, that he's a sailor, but he also has more to him than that. He's a fighter, but he also learned that women weren't necessarily interested in men who were good at punching. They were attracted to skills more refined than the pugilist art. I'm quoting the song here. And he learns to dance, and he charms Meg as young kids do, through dancing. And so that's his entree into the world of romance.
Hmm. Fictional character or someone that you're based on that you knew?
Probably a bit of me there. Not that I can dance, but, I think music... I was born on a pretty tough street.
Well, let's hear the night the pugilist learned how to dance, then more with Sting and Francis McNamee.
There was nobody tougher than me. I was quick with me fists and fast with me footwork, as you can plainly see. But while fighting was useful for getting your way among the toughs of the town, well, you could all swear there had to be something that was better than this. I was 15 years old and I'd never been kissed. Well, of course, she'd ignore me. Our friends would all sneer at me bloody nose dripping and me cauliflower ear. For it's hard to convince in a romantic pose with a lovely black eye and a broken nose. Where a girl is attracted to skills more refined than the pugilist's art. And so I inclined to take myself serious as a modern romancer, and I secretly learned all the moves of a dancer. You swing to the left, you swing to the right, keep your eyes on your partner, more or less like a fight. You just follow the rhythm and you keep to the beat. The important thing's never to look at your feet. Then a miracle happens. Your mind's in a trance, though the strategy's subtle. Retreat in advance. It's all about attitude, all in your stance. Attention to detail, leaving nothing to chance. Which explains how the pugilist finally learned how to dance. Well, I'd waltz with a broomstick, and if I was caught, I'd pretend I was sweeping or practicing sport. But I really had eyes for your mother, you see.
wanting her to acknowledge this new version of me. But now everyone's watching, expecting I'll fail. But this fire in me belly, there's wind in me sails. I knew I was risky, and I was taking a chance. I couldn't retreat now, I had to advance. So I swing to the left, I swing to the right. Keep me eyes on me partner, like I wouldn't a fight. I just keep to the rhythm and follow the beat. The important thing's never to look at your feet. But a miracle's happened and your mind's in a trance. They're all laughing and cheering and looking askance. On the night that the pugilist finally learned how to dance. It's a 3-minute round and you're back in your corner. You're licking your wounds just like little Jack Horner. Don't let your guard down. Try a jab with your right, or you're losing on points by the end of the night. Then a miracle happens, and everyone's screaming. You're pinching yourself just in case you're still dreaming. You've taken the initiative, you've taken your chance. It's the night when this pugilist finally learned how to dance. About where the strategist's bridges were burnt, where it seemed that his fortune had suddenly turned. 'Twas the night that the scrapper was suddenly dapper, and this poor fellow's heart was still gone like the clappers. The night that the pugilist finally learned how to dance.
From The Last Ship, music by Sting, sung by Sting, my guest here in KLW Studios. A beautiful tune, Sting. Thank you so Thank much you. For that. It's really a beautiful lilt to it. And I love the parallels between a swing to the left and a swing to the right. Mm-hmm. Here also with Francis McNamee, one of the cast members of The Last Ship at the Golden Gate Theater through March 22nd, BroadwaySF.com for more information. Well, more than... One, well, before we get to this, there's some listener questions that came in. I understand that you two have a bit of a competition going on as to who can hold a note the longest. Now, how did that get started, and what's the score these days?
We've never actually competed face-to-face, and I don't think we should.
No. Well, you can turn the other way.
I have a reputation.
Blood vessels will
so
be burst. Yeah, exactly.
And you got a show to do tonight, too. We'll look for that on YouTube. How's that?
I think it started when we did a promo week in San Francisco and L.A. last year, And we sort of impromptu kind of did a bit of that. We have done a little sing off, and I think you pit me to the post, and I tried to this footage of me trying to sort of claw back some dignity a bit later on, and the audience finding that quite amusing. So I think it's kind of spiraled from there, perhaps.
We do have big lungs in the northeast of England.
Oh yeah.
All right. Well, I did make a little social posting and asked, what do you want to ask Sting? Help me out here with some questions. And more than one friend wanted to hear about tantric sex. Maybe not ideal for public radio.
Well, we don't really have time.
I guess not. And more than one friend asked for your hand in marriage, or at least your room number, and most of those were my gay friends. So I hope that's taken as a compliment.
Totally.
My friend John Brummel writes, what gets you up early and keeps you up late?
I could very rarely sleep in, although this morning I did. But I get up when the sun comes up. As a child, I used to help my father on the milk round, and I was out in the streets every morning while all my friends were in bed delivering milk on all weathers. Then I go to bed pretty late, but... hopefully before midnight most nights, and healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you working on now? You seem to be more of a chameleon than a tree frog. On Russians from your first album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles, using a theme from Prokofiev's Lieutenant Kiji Suite, also influenced by the raw power of the punk scene in London, incorporating the complexities of reggae, rap. So what's in the hopper? Who are you working with?
You know, music for me is a common language. It's not a series of ghettos. It's something that's accessible to me as a common language, and I feel inspired by the whole spectrum of music and not just one branch of it. So I tend to work with musicians who have that same ethos, who can play jazz, who can play folk music, who can play classical music. And, you know, we're thieves. Musicians are thieves. Composers are thieves. We steal from all available sources and then make it our own. And then someone steals from us.
As, there was a copyright issue, I believe.
Of course there's a copyright issue, but no one invented music.
True enough. Perhaps another musical down the road, or is this a one-off?
I'd love to find a subject that I would find as passionate as this one. Something as, you know, all-embracing and personal. That's difficult.
My friend Marla asks, are you going to do perhaps another Police reunion?
No.
That's done. Okay. Let's see. Your interest in the lute. What do you think of the Theorbo? And have you ever considered writing a ballet score? My friend Richard Vaughn asks.
I immersed myself in the lute for a number of years. And the music of John Dowland, who was England's first real traveling extant composer whose name we know. He wrote an incredible song. So really he is the forerunner of, you know, the modern troubadour. His music is extraordinary. Art songs, very, very complex. The lute is a nightmare to play. My lute had 26 strings. I could hit most of them. But it was a very absorbing chapter in my life, which I got a great deal from. There are a few musical ideas in The Last Ship which come from John Dowland, actually. I'm not going to tell you what they are, but they're there.
All right. My friend Ben Riley, also a songwriter, asks, how do you get inspiration for hooks for new songs?
I wish I knew. Sometimes the music will write the words, and sometimes the words will write the music, or they happen simultaneously. I wish that I knew the rule, but you know, it's a very ephemeral thing that keeps moving. You can't hit the same button twice. You have to be in a state of grace to find it, which isn't very often in my case.
Now, one of our KLW stalwarts, Dee Dee, asks, very curious about time signatures and the meters you choose in your songs.
If I'm just sat playing the guitar, invariably I'm playing in some complex meter, not just 4/4 time. That song you just heard is in 3. It's a waltz, but I like 7/8. I love 7/8. I love 5/4. Anything that surprises me. Mm-hmm. For me, the essence of good music is surprise. If someone gives me a tape of theirs and say, listen to that, I'll say, okay, I'll give you 8 bars. If you haven't surprised me within 8 bars, I'm turning this off because life is too short.
And finally, Jeremy Cohen, a wonderful jazz violinist, says, brilliant. And then how or by whom do you seek creative criticism?
Say it again.
How or by whom do you get creative criticism from?
By my colleagues. You know, I have a good rapport with musicians who have a creative stake in what we're doing, and I invite consensus. At the end of the day, I will make an executive decision about what I agree with, but I certainly invite consensus. And I've always worked with musicians better than me. This has been my strategy, because to play in the same game, you have to raise your game. So working with the best musicians in the world, which is something I've managed to do, has given me a lift. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm not arrogant, but I know how to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Francis McNamee, you're on Cloud 9 doing the show now. Are there roles, Broadway or off-Broadway, that you're looking forward to tackle after this?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd love to have a go at Waitress. That would be great. But what's been brilliant about doing this show is that it's felt like you've been a part of something, because we changed the book. It's felt like I've been with it from the very start, and it's something very exciting about working on something brand new, because you're always changing, it's always evolving. So I'd like to see what new projects are out there for me to be a part of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, come back and see us when you have something here in town.
Yeah, sure, I will.
Sting, such a charmed life. 30-plus years with Trudy. Congratulations. 7-time grandfather. How does that feel?
Are you putting that in the same breath? Like my marriage to Trudy and my Grammys? Trudy and I have an extraordinary relationship. You know, we love each other, clearly, but actually like each other. I enjoy her company. She laughs at my jokes, and I laugh at hers. We have a shared sense of history, where, you know, she's only a couple of years younger than me, so we have the same nostalgias, which is wonderful.
Both fond of organic gardening and fine chocolate.
She sent me a tape of her this morning singing some old commercial from the 60s, Fairy Liquid. She's just very charming.
Well, speaking of different...
She's a nut as well.
Different sorts of projects with her directing and her yoga work. I heard a clip of you singing Mac the Knife on Broadway and singing My One and Only Love, which you sung beautifully. Any further interest in recording the Great American Songbook?
I have recorded the Great American Songbook, but I've done it for fun, and it's just lying fallow.
All right.
I think it would send a message out that I've run out of ideas to do that. I love the American Songbook. Absolutely love it, and I will sing it at the drop of a hat, but I don't need to release it.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you not only for just being here and taking the time today, but for 10 Summoner's Tales, or shall we call them 10 Summoner's Tales? Mm-hmm. And, of course, The Last Ship. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to go out with. What have we got?
What have we got is a work song, which I think it opens our show, right?
It does.
It does. It opens the show, and I sing it. Basically, it's ambiguous about how hard life in the shipyard is, but also how proud we are of actually working there and what we do.
Well, thank you so much both for coming in.
Thank you.
From The Last Ship, what have we got?
Good people, give ear to me story. Pay attention and none of your lip. For I brought you 5 lads and their daddy. And tendons have built just a ship. While Flanders war habitation, it's a place whose are born and bred. And there's me finer lads in the niche, and none are more gallantly. Upon the river, tell me what have we got for the noise inside the hole. Oh, what have we got for the outside of the weather, where we work in horizontal rain and shiver in the cold. What do you got?
What do you got?
You got nout.
We've got nout else.
What do you got?
What do you got?
You got nout.
We've got nout else.
What have you got? Put the singing in the cable.
Oh, what do you got?
Put the ringing in your ears.
Oh, what do you got?
Put the telling of the fables and the memories of the ships that we've been building donkey's years.
What do you got?
What do we got?
Oh, what do you got?
What do we got?
We got nout.
We got nout else.
Oh, what do you got?
What do we got?
What do you got?
What do we got?
You got nout.
We got nout else.
Ah, you gonna die of something. It's written in your face.
You may as well die of a Tuesday, but we'll be tight, you're late.
What do you got?
All you men what's fit and able.
What do you got?
For the stranded on your neck.
What do you got?
When you're laid out on a table.
table, the snapping of a cable when the rigging hits the deck. What do you got?
From the Last Ship, Sting's musical at the Golden Gate Theater through March 22nd.
Music from The Last Ship, created by Sting, which was on tour here in San Francisco in February of 2020, its final stop before being shut down by the pandemic. Please note once again that this was an archived interview and that performance dates mentioned were from 2020. I'm David LaTulipe, and all this month we'll be revisiting the On the Arts archive for some memorable visitors to the KALW studios during the past 18 years or so that I have had the honor of hosting the show. My thanks to Janice Lee for producing the show, and to today's board operator, Tariq Ansari, and to all of you for listening. Let's go out with additional music from The Last Ship. Here's Sting and Company and Shipyard.
We've built battleships and cruisers for Her Majesty the Queen, super tankers for Onassis and all the classes in between. We've built the greatest shipping tonnage that the world has ever seen. And the only life we've known is in the shipyard. All the platers and the welders and the boiler-making crews, when they see that beggar finished on the slipway, all the hardships soon forgot, and we'll cheer as like as not. And the bands will wave their Union Jacks all day. Oh, it's a periodic scene. All that's missing is the Queen. But you said you couldn't make it other Tuesday. Then something wells up here inside, and you could take it in your stride. But you wonder if you'll see another payday. For there's a mixture of emotions, hatred, gratitude and pride. And you hate yourself for crying, but it's difficult to hide. But there's a sadness in the leaving, and you worry what's ahead. And that worry never leaves you, keeps on nagging in your head. And so you pray to God for orders, but you'll worry till you're dead. Until they bury your remains in the blacksmith's shed. And the only life you've known is in the shipyard.
Steel in the stockyard, iron in the store. We'll conjure up a ship where there used to be a home.
And I don't know what we'll do if this yard gets sold. For the only life we've known is in the shipyard.
And I'm shop steward for the Union. My dream is proletarian revolution.
Get out, Tom.
Comrades, brothers, fellow travelers and others, class struggle is the means of dialectic evolution. Das Kapital's revival and the ruling class are liable. And Korn, Marx and Engels, it's entirely justifiable. If the workers' revolution here is ever to revival, and we become the rightful owners of the shipyard. So it's a one-day stoppage, or an overtake ban, or a work parole for the five-year plan. Till the means of production are safely in our hands, and we become the rightful owners of the shipyard. I'm not saying it won't be hard if the boss answers me cards, when they try to close us down like other shipyards, and if industrial action...